Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. Obama hails climate deal. U.S. President Barack Obama is hailing the climate agreement reached by nearly 200 nations in Paris, while noting American leadership was key to successful negotiations aimed at curbing global carbon emissions. VOA correspondent Arup Pandey reports from the White House.
Obama said the deal would mean less carbon pollution and more economic growth while helping developing nations implement clean energy programs through public and private financing.
Moreover, this agreement sends a powerful signal that the world is firmly committed to a low carbon future, and that has the potential to unleash investment and innovation in clean energy at a scale we have never seen before.
Obama noted American leadership on climate change was instrumental to reaching the historic global deal. Domestically, he cited U.S. investment in wind, solar, and other clean energy that helped create jobs and new nationwide standards aimed at cutting emissions from coal-fired plants by more than a third by the year 2030. Arup Pandey, VOA News, The White House.
World powers are meeting with Libyan officials on a UN-backed plan that is designed to unite Libya's fractured government before a signing ceremony on the proposal that is set for Wednesday. Italian Foreign Minister Paolo Gentiloni and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry are leading the talks today in Rome. Libyans taking part in the talks include officials with the internationally recognized government as well as the rival militia alliance. Kerry tweeted, "Conflict, instability in Libya have gone on for too long." We invite you to visit our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Officials in northwestern Pakistan say a bomb blast ripped through a busy clothing market today, killing at least 15 people and wounding about 50 others. Authorities say the death toll is expected to rise. The explosion happened in the administrative center of the semi-autonomous Karam tribal district on the Afghan border. The political administrator of Karam told the French news agency the bomb had been hidden in a bag left at the market. The tribal region has been the site of violence from Islamic militants and sectarian conflict between Sunni and Shiite Muslims. Swiss officials have confirmed the arrest of two people of Syrian origin as part of a probe into a terror threat. The two people were arrested in Geneva Friday on suspicion of making, hiding, and transporting explosive and toxic gases. Criminal proceedings have been opened against the two under a law prohibiting terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Oliver Junot is the prosecutor general for the Canton of Geneva.
Ces personnes, en raison de leur comportement et de leur nationalité, ont été soumis à des contrôles accrus.
He says those persons, because of their behavior and their nationality, were subjected to increased police checks and police control. And those controls revealed the presence of traces of explosives in the vehicle they used. Authorities in the Geneva region have been searching for four suspected jihadists with alleged ties to Islamic State, but police have not said whether Friday's arrests were connected to that search. At least two women have won municipal council seats in Saudi Arabia's first election open to women voters and candidates. Early results today show Salma Bint Hizab Al-Attabi is the first confirmed victory for a woman running for a municipal council seat, beating out seven men and two other women for the position of Madaraka, about 150 kilometers north of Mecca. Of the 6,440 candidates in the local elections, about 900 were women, despite obstacles in running and registering to vote, Human Rights Watch reported. The rights watchdog said the distance to voter registration centers and required ID cards that many women do not have hindered the process. A 23-year-old man is under arrest in the western U.S. state of California for allegedly setting fire to a mosque in the state. Police arrested the suspect shortly after the incident. He is facing multiple charges, including arson and a hate crime offense. No one was hurt in the fire. The mosque was hit by gunfire last year. The mosque is in the same state where a radical Islamic couple killed 14 people and wounded 22 others in what investigators say is an act of terror. The couple was later killed by police during a gun battle. Once again, our website, voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Most people who are going to be voting haven't actually seen it. Only 15,000 copies were printed and distributed around the country.
The Central African Republic votes in a constitutional referendum despite concerns of insecurity and logistical challenges.
The military, you know, who were in charge of the safety and security of Joe Biden himself and his convoy, they had no choice other than to defend themselves.
The Nigerian army chief survives a reported attack by an Islamic group.
The government we're expecting and the beneficiaries to contribute about $5 million, and another co-financier still to be identified. We are working around that, another $10 million.
And the Zimbabwean government and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, sign a debt rescheduling agreement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Central African Republic votes in a constitutional referendum Sunday amid concerns of insecurity and logistical challenges. The vote is seen as a key test ahead of much-delayed presidential and parliamentary polls. Parts of the country are still controlled by rebels who could disrupt voting. For VOA, Nick Long reports.
The United Nations mission in CAR, MINUSCA, has been scrambling to make Sunday's vote happen. MINUSCA Chief Parfait Onanga Anyanga said Friday that the mission had flown more than 60 flights and transported about 100 tons of electoral materials to all the country's 15 regional capitals in the past 48 hours. These preparations were held up by delays in producing the constitution that Central Africans are supposed to vote on. The CAR researcher for Human Rights Watch, Lewis Mudge, told VOA his office only received a copy of the 47-page document 2 days ago.
Most people who are going to be voting haven't actually seen it. Only 15,000 copies were printed and distributed around the country.
He added there's been too little attempt to explain the proposed changes.
There's been some outreach, but outreach on both the constitutional referendum and on the upcoming election has been very poor by the national electoral authorities.
Voting could be disrupted in some parts of the country. Mudge said there's particular concern about the Nanagribezi area, one of the country's 15 prefectures, where armed group leader Nuruddin Adam, former number two of the mainly Muslim ex-Seleka group, has been saying the electoral process should not go ahead. Elsewhere, the ex-Seleka and mainly Christian anti-Balaka armed group could both intimidate voters. The referendum is likely to pass, allowing presidential elections to go ahead, says Mudge.
There is large consensus that the referendum will pass, mostly because the government has gone on a vote yes campaign. And, you know, if it does pass, then I think the vote's going to happen. Is it going to be successful? Depends on your definition of successful.
2 million voters have been registered, which is a record for the country. Still, with about 1 million of the 5 million population either in exile or displaced within the country, with only 35% of Muslim exiles who are eligible to vote actually registered, and with conflict continuing even in the capital, holding the referendum and the elections are big challenges. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The Nigerian Chief of Army Staff, Lieutenant General Tukur Yusuf Buratai's convoy, was attacked by members of an Islamic group loyal to Sheikh Ibrahim el-Zakzaki in the northern city of Zaria on Saturday. Military spokesman Colonel Sani Kukashika Osman says the soldiers in charge of protecting the army chief thwarted the attack. But the Islamic group denied firing and stopping the convoy of the army chief moving through the area. They accused the army of a cover-up in an ongoing attempt to crush Zakzaki and his movement. Colonel Osman told me that the Islamic group is to blame for the attack.
It is quite true in the sense that yesterday afternoon, when the convoy of the chief of army staff coming from Duz-e Jigawa State, you know, we had a 1 week annual conference of the chief of army staff at that city. And on his way to pay homage to the emir of Zazo, and subsequently review the passing out parade of the 73 regular recruits intake of Depot Nigerian Army Zaria, a group of youth, along Husseiniyah Bakia, which is the headquarters of the Shiite sect in Zaria, barricaded the roads, burning tires, forming bonfire with dangerous weapon, insisting that the chief of army staff will not pass. Not only him, any other person. It was made abundantly clear who he was and what was his mission, but they remained adamant. They refused. Rather, they found out, took up positions with dangerous weapons. And unfortunately, there was loud bang and explosion. The military, who were in charge of the safety and security of Joe Army staff and his convoy, they had no choice other than to defend themselves and open the road for law-abiding citizens to pass.
Now,
but the Joe Army staff escaped unhurt.
Colonel Usman, the group said that it is not true that an attempt was made on the chief of army's life and that the army's attack was well too planned and that the army is using this as a pretext to crush the group, which they say consists of law-abiding citizens in that part of the country.
That assertion is not correct. Personally, I was there. The records are there. The good thing is that we always move along with the journalists who are the witness to all this, and they recorded everything. And apart from that, there are other witnesses too.
The group said three of the sons of the leader of the group, Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki, have been targeted in the past, and yesterday's incident is an indication that the army is selectively crushing Islamic groups in the country. What is your reaction to that?
There is no plan whatsoever. Nobody had ever thought about that. Believe me, sincerely speaking, the incidents could have been avoided had it been that they did not barricade that road, they did not make an attempt on the life of the chief of army staff. Brandishing weapons, coming out with guns and other dangerous weapons. It is there. They knew abundantly, it was made abundantly clear to them that, look, this was the chief of army staff. Whatever problem, whatever grievances they have, now he is here. Allow him pass it so that we can, settle down and discuss this issue and negotiate it further. But they refused. And even all efforts to make sure that their leader comes out so that he would prevail on them, rather, the situation kept on aggravating, finding out and cycling, the convoy of the chief of army staff. And you need to be at that environment to know, from the bike here down to the polo club, down to railway clinic.
The accusation of the Islamic group is that the army want to execute its leader, Sheikh Ibrahim El Zakzaki, and they insist that the Islamic movement has mass support across Nigeria and is renowned as a peaceful group that has never been implicated in any violence and that it strongly opposes Boko Haram. What is your reaction to statement that the army plans to execute the leader?
There is no such plan. The Nigerian army is a professional military force that is law-abiding, that is guided by the rules and rules of engagement and the principles of rule of law. We are established by the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. There has never been a time where the army acted unilaterally to harm or antagonize a law-abiding innocent citizen of the country. They perpetrated a crime, and now it's suddenly down on them that what they did was wrong. And in any case, yesterday, they told three divergent stories. First and foremost, they made allegations that their members were killed in far away Bagari, and that is why they would not allow anybody exit or entry. Suddenly, they said, They were going to bury some people. Then suddenly, their leader came out with the story again that they were raising a flag, and as such, everybody has to stand still. This is Federal Republic of Nigeria. There is no flag that is far more sacred than the flag, the national flag of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. You cannot deprive any law-abiding citizen of the country freedom of association, freedom of movement. But every now and then they do that, and it is always violent. The records are there. They had weapons.
Colonel Sani Kukashuka Usman is the Nigerian military spokesman. He spoke with me from Kaduna in northern Nigeria. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi recently met with the heads of state of more than 50 African countries to discuss ways to improve the continent's health infrastructure. The talks also focus on extending the reach of India's lucrative generic drug industry into Africa, where the need for low-cost medications is great. Viewer's Jessica Berman has more.
Developing countries in Africa are battling a host of deadly infectious diseases, from diarrheal conditions to malaria to HIV. Most low-cost generic antiretroviral drugs to treat HIV have come from India. India's drug industry, which has become the world's leader in the manufacture and export of generic drugs, could fill the need for drugs for other conditions as well. The drugs cost a fraction of the originals. Exports have reaped $15 billion for the Indian economy by some estimates. But inspectors have identified factories that produce substandard drugs that are dangerous, either because they contain toxic ingredients or simply do not work. Health economist Roger Bate is with the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington-based research organization. Fake malaria drugs have already made it to Africa, and Bate worries that more copycat drugs could be on the way.
India seems to segment its markets. It sends, on average, it sends the better quality medicines to richer countries like the U.S., and the medicines that don't pass quality control, it sends to poorer nations, particularly those in Africa.
Global health consultant Gaurav Nayar confirms that poorly made and counterfeit drugs are being exported to poorer countries. Nayar says she's visited some of the sham factories, but she says knowing about the problem and doing something about it are two different things.
You can see that there's children in the market buying this counterfeit product, taking it and dying, and that's actually what inspired me to work on the problem. But it's how do you translate that into policy and action that we can actually fix it? And that's where I think this entire engine is stuck.
Nayar says samples of drugs that have made it to market have been tested for purity and effectiveness. But she says tracing bad drugs back to the source can be extremely difficult. Most generics do what they're supposed to do, and countries that import them do not want to harm anyone. But Bate says health officials in poorer nations face a dilemma.
You know, the immediate response of anyone taking the drugs is horror at that kind of, you know, a position, because they'll say, surely you should just boycott the product. The reality is that it's very difficult to do that because you end up with significant shortages.
For their part, experts say countries in Africa are also interested in getting into the business of manufacturing generic drugs, both as a way to boost their economies and get life-saving medications to their people. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The leader of the South Sudanese opposition SPLM-IO says he is disappointed with the actions of President Salva Kiir's administration. Dr. Riek Machar says the implementation of the peace agreement depends on the presence of his advance team in the capital, Juba. Machar told South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza that the international community must put pressure on the government in Juba to implement the peace agreement.
We are responding again to the government to allow our advance team to go. We have 7 points which we think we would work together with the government. One, the speedy dissemination of the peace among various communities in the country is one objective. The other objective is to ensure that the reconciliation process is kicked off very speedily by our advanced team. The third is that we want the process of confidence building among our membership and the government party to be also tackled. Fourth, we want to encourage the IDPs that are in the UN camps to want to encourage to go to back to their houses and villages.
The government in Juba is saying that your number is too big, and they are saying if you can reduce them, they will appreciate. You are saying you want to send this big number because they are supposed to do the things that you are listing. Now, this is going to take a long time before the two of you agree on the number of the advance team. In the meantime, if there's going to be no progress, what is plan B?
The government is not paying for the transport of our advance team. Second, the government is not paying for the accommodation in Juba. Third, the government is not paying for the transport of the state advance teams. They're not. It costs them nothing at all. So their objection on security grounds is baseless. After all, they're not armed. Most of them are political activists, members of parliament, either the national, legislative, or the council of state. We see no reason why they should create a fuss out of it.
This number you're talking about is 600 plus. How are you taking care of these people in Pagak?
I tell you, it's very difficult. Huh? We are more than that because we had a conference, a peace implementation conference, and the people are waiting. Some will go back to where they came from, but the advance team is stuck with me here. Feeding them is not an easy task.
South Sudanese people at this moment, with all the economic hardship in Juba and all over the country, are really waiting to hear a definite answer from the leadership of the country about when will this peace agreement be implemented. If you're given an opportunity to assure them, what would you tell them?
The implementation of the peace agreement starts with the advance team. Once our advance team arrives Juba, and in actual fact, they join the JMAC, which is the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. Our members will be in that advance team. Our members also in the CTSAM, that is Ceasefire Transitional Security Monitoring Mechanism, our three members will be there. And then the JMCC, the Joint Military Ceasefire Commission, our members will also be in that team. And then the National Constitutional Amendment Committee, our members are also in that. So the institutions for implementation of the peace agreement, the members will be in the advance team. So the process of implementing the peace agreement would be kicked off very speedily with the arrival of our advance team.
That's Dr. Riek Machar, leader of the South Sudanese opposition, SPLM-IO. He spoke with South Sudan in Focus's John Tanza from his headquarters in Pagak, Upper Nile State. Zimbabwe and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, have signed a debt rescheduling agreement that will result in IFAD resuming financial support to Zimbabwe. IFAD will initially provide $55 million under the country's Smallholder Irrigation Revitalization Program next year. For VOA, Ivan Chifera reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
IFAD Regional Director for East and Southern Africa, San Jata, who was in Harare to sign the deal, said the organization, which suspended projects in Zimbabwe over 23 million arrears, was re-engaging it in a new deal that has seen Zimbabwe pay 10% of the arrears and made an undertaking to pay the remainder over a five-year period. He said the program, to be funded by IFAD, will rehabilitate and develop new smallholder irrigation schemes covering 8,000 hectares and benefiting more than 20,000 households.
The government, we are expecting, and the beneficiaries to contribute about $5 million, and another co-financier still to be identified. We are working around that, another $10 million.
He said IFAD will provide more financial resources if Zimbabwe does not fall into arrears again. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa said, due to climate change, government efforts to develop agriculture must focus on irrigation.
We have no choice. This is now out of necessity, and we should plow and deploy more resources in this sector. So the assistance that we are going to get, the resources that we are expecting to obtain from IFAD, will be a major shot in the arm of the agricultural sector in this country, especially irrigation development.
Deputy Agriculture and Mechanization Minister Paddy Shanda said the agricultural sector continues to face many challenges, such as lack of adequate inputs and climate change. He said resources from IFAD should be used to address these issues and ensure food security, especially in rural areas.
The program will sustainably increase diversification of production, productivity and household incomes for smallholder farmers. This support is aligned to the Food and Nutrition Cluster, the ZIM Asset Economic Blueprint, and the 10-point plan for economic growth, whose fundamental pillar is revitalization of the agriculture sector and the agro-processing value chain.
Tirarami Muyambo, an agricultural extension officer with a local non-governmental organization, said while he was not aware of the details of the IFAD program, irrigation was the best way to go, especially for the country's natural regions 4 and 5.
Issues of irrigation are critical in this country because you know that due to climate change, areas in Region 5, in Chipinge, where I have so much knowledge on, I have been experiencing drought almost year in, year out. So it's a welcome development. I think it will change and help in rebuilding redeveloping food security in Zimbabwe.
The IFAD program will have four components, namely rehabilitation and development of irrigation infrastructure, agricultural credit, institutional strengthening, and market access and business development. Government in the meantime is expected to establish a unit that would coordinate the implementation of the program. Chinamasa said the gesture by IFAD was an indication that the government's re-engagement effort with the international community was paying off, and government would do all it can to achieve full admission into the community of nations. Zimbabwe requires long-term financing to reboot its economy, but is constrained by external debts which have blocked the flow of international capital into the country. IFAD has been operating in Zimbabwe since 1980 and cancelled its support to the country in 2006 after it defaulted on its arrears. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there.
Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, right here in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy. See this loving way I get, he's gonna take away your sorrow. See this loving way I get, he's gonna stay until tomorrow. See this loving way I get, take the lead and I will follow. Baby, always, always,
take away your sorrow. See this loving way I get. He's gonna stay until tomorrow. making me mad. Cause the way you pull it down, make me want to go mad. Oh my God, girl, the way you grind. And every time I see you, I'm blind. The way you handle that. Uku!
Mastercraft on the beat.
Mega. Like, girl, dangerous. The way you do, girl, you are dangerous. Anytime I see you move it, girl, you are dangerous.
Mega.
Baby, girl, you are dangerous. Mega. Yeah. Everybody now. Oh, my God. Tell me your mind. No. We want to make you mine. Baby, girl, you come at me from mine. Take me down to major. The way you handle that. Uku.
Yeah. she know the tire. Caro the one time every minute. Caro the make me feel the lazy. Caro the make my head the bang. Caro the make me want the craze. But I'm still looking for Caro.
Chop money.
Hey, it's good to be saving for rainy days.
Not so,
cause you know it's here. Life is so delicate. Oh, so make una see me as evidence. Baba God, now my confidence.
Yes,
his blessings are endless. So,
oh,
as if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble. Oh,
hey.
I continue the struggle. Oh, the struggle they double my hustle. Oh,
hey.
As if he said, I don't go. Some people they bubble. Oh,
hey.
I continue the struggle. Oh, they double my hustle. Yeah. Now I'm giving my testimony.
Oh,
I'm killing the beat and I'm giving them heat. Oh.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. China is on the march in Africa. Concerted efforts in some segment of the global media to convince Africa that China has embarked on a neo-colonialism of Africa has failed. It is possible that some Africans have believed that myth, but we must not forget what colonialism was in Africa. European powers had come into that continent, sometimes with some gifts, some arms, small arms, and they have hoodwinked the leaders of Africa, and it is by that means that they occupied almost all of the continents. Colonialism is also a fact that at the Berlin Conference, European powers sat together with a map without any African presence and partitioned Africa for their colonial rule. China has done nothing of the sort. China has tried since the victory of the Communist Party in China to relate with Africa. And the Chinese have never forgotten the role that Africa played in its gaining of its rightful place in the United Nations in 1971. China has also emerged as a major economic power. And despite resistance by the International Monetary Fund, IMF, last week, the IMF succumbed and agreed to make the Chinese currency yuan as one of the reserve currency for special drawing rights. This is a major, major victory for China in terms of its economy and finance. It will facilitate its dealing with many countries, particularly in Africa. Shortly after that news was announced by the IMF, the president of China, Xi, visited the major country in Africa, Zimbabwe, whose leader has found himself in great hot water with European countries. And after the meeting in Zimbabwe, Xi proceeded to Pretoria in South Africa for the China-African Summit. That summit advanced China's relationship with Africa in the economic and financial sense, and one can say that relationship, which goes back into Bandung in 1955 until the present, has now matured. In the speech by President Xi, he gave a 10-point plan. And that 10-point plan came to a figure of $60 billion credit line that will deal with a whole array of economic matters dealing with infrastructure, with economic assistance, with loan grants. And this will be the basis of the further development in the relationship between China and Africa. Now, it opts to the African countries themselves to see how best they can go forward with this relationship. But there will be attempts, as in the past, to warn some Africans, and some of them may fall into the trap. But what Africans must see is the genuine help of Africa to a continent which is in the field of poverty. China has given the way, and hopefully Africa will learn from China on how it managed to develop its economy and to lift its people out of poverty. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Jiang Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the little opportunity given to a monkey to wear clothes does not guarantee it to join the dining. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the Helsinki Final Act marks its 40th anniversary, it is critical that all members of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe remain faithful to its core principles. These principles include recognizing the inherent dignity and human rights of every person, respecting the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every participating state, and refraining from the threat or use of force across the OSCE region. In light of these commitments, the United States renews its call for Russia and the separatists that it backs to fully implement the Minsk agreements to which Moscow is a signatory. This includes the removal of Russian forces and equipment from eastern Ukraine and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has emphasized the importance of the Minsk agreement's provision for local elections in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to be carried out under Ukrainian law and subject to monitoring by the OSCE Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights. There must also be a return to Ukrainian control of the border and the release of all hostages detained for politically motivated reasons. Meanwhile, Ukraine needs to do its part by withdrawing its heavy weapons and to negotiate in good faith the Donbas election procedures. This is a time for concrete steps, said Secretary Kerry at the recent OSCE ministerial meeting in Serbia, and to avoid what is a disastrous but unnecessary conflict, and to begin the process of rebuilding Ukraine's east. Elsewhere in the OSCE, protracted conflicts continue in places like Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria, Georgia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. The protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms throughout the OSCE region continues to be a priority. In too many countries, said Secretary Kerry, non-governmental organizations are being restricted by new laws. Journalism is under attack and the freedom of expression, including the media, is in jeopardy, sometimes by threat of force. There is no acceptable excuse for abusing the rights of citizens, for preventing journalists from doing their jobs, or from silencing legitimate political dissent. I hope that we will all reaffirm these fundamental ideals, said Secretary Kerry. The enduring promise of Helsinki should inspire all of us to tackle these shared challenges with renewed urgency and to continue our efforts in building a Europe and a Eurasia that is whole and free and at peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.